It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What is school for?
I did not love going to school.
Meet Karen McKechnie. She is a senior at Cornell College, and she was our intern this summer.
I would say that at the worst, I would attend maybe 3 or 4 of my classes a day. And I remember my high school counselor telling me, oh, like, you're technically a truant right now, Karin. And, like, there was some truancy meeting coming up because my attendance was so poor. But I then did not attend the truancy meeting. So that would probably be the one of the low points.
This is Madison's West High, and in this hallway there are dozens of kids shrugging off their backpacks, opening lockers, getting ready for another day of tests and assignments. This is the place where Karin skipped all those classes, but where she also met a few teachers who inspired her, who got her thinking about what education could and should be, what school is for. And that's our question this hour. And Karin? Well, actually, Karin is planning on coming back to this school, or one like it, as a teacher, even though there was so much about it she didn't like.
School felt like a sort of sterile, artificial site where you go, you do homework, strive to get those A's, rinse and repeat. It was exhausting. And I looked around. It didn't seem like that many of my peers were happy, and neither was I. So even though I was pretty disenchanted with school, I ended up falling in love with a high school English class. The teacher who taught that class, Mr. Storm, would come to class and describe something that had happened to him. And it would be connected to, say, Macbeth. It was the first time that I'd felt like learning and life were the same thing. So I got back in touch with Mr. Storm. I want to go in and see if the if your bulletin board is still there.
It is.
Really?
Yes.
Why were you guys back there?
I wanted to talk to him about teaching.
Hey. Good, how are you?
So we met at West High and found someone to let us into his old classroom.
Oh, it looks like it was waxed, too.
Yeah.
There you go. It's locked, so when you close it in.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yep.
Good to see you.
You too.
There it is. Stay in school, learn the system, then change the system before it changes you. Oh, my God.
What?
How is that still up?
What is it? We're looking at his bulletin board, which, after all these years, is still up.
English sophomore class?
With all of his cartoons.
From 3 years ago?
And bumper stickers with clever things. Felt very nostalgic. Yeah, it's nice to come back and have it still be here. What are you looking at?
I think you sat back here your sophomore year.
Yep, this is my spot. Always in the back.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
I can't believe he remembered where you sat. Doesn't that seem unusual?
He did remember students and their faces and their names uncannily well. He has a good memory for students.
Well, I remember you were a sophomore in English Lit.
I was missing some assignments.
There were smaller assignments that you weren't turning in.
Small assignments.
And I was like, what's going on? And I remember talking to you.
Because I felt badly.
And learning and being sort of surprised that
I was pretty behind in.
You were actually way behind in a lot of classes.
Then we got to talking about why that was.
He was a very capable and engaged student.
I started to share with him some of my schooling frustrations.
What's that all about?
And he identified with a lot of them. But on the other end, as a teacher, and I knew that he felt like he was burning out. Every year he'd been like, oh, I'm not sure, this might be my last year. And so I wasn't surprised to hear that he'd left. I remember learning that he wanted to quit. So we'd have these conversations where I would say, I don't like high school.
And he would say, I don't either?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd say, I don't like high school, I want to drop out. And he would say, I don't like high school, I want to quit.
The thought was probably there from the inception. The first few years are crazy. 12-hour days, 5 days a week, binge grading on the weekends. There's some days where you just come home, you'd be like, oh my God, there's no way I can do this. But the point is, a lot of those initial stressors sort of go away. And so there's sort of a transition period where you're like, okay, I think I could do this for a while. But the job never stays the same. And then political stuff happens that threatens the work environment in new ways. But to a certain extent, also maybe double down as like, yes, but I believe in teaching and I believe in public education.
Is he talking about the political changes that began in Wisconsin when Scott Walker became governor and wanted to end the teachers' unions?
Yeah, he is. He's talking about 2010, exactly when that happened. There were walkouts. I think there were millions of people at the Capitol.
Yeah.
It was a hit to income. It was a hit to security. Like, am I going to be confident that I can walk into the same workplace a year from now and not be told that I have to teach 6 classes instead of 5? Am I in a position where I know that my class size isn't going to balloon up to like 40 or something? Accompanied actually by the political salesmanship of politicians to sell what they were doing to teachers, which resulted in just this subtle cultural attack on teachers.
Or not so subtle.
Sometimes not so subtle. But you'd see it from, I try not to partake in a lot of Facebook discussions, but you would see it. You'd see it from like people you know who would say these awful things about the teaching profession and teachers. There was definitely this feeling of antipathy toward me and what I do.
This must make going into teaching seem a little scary to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm scared. My biggest fear is burning out.
From the workload?
The workload, the general attitude toward teaching that he describes, this denigration of the profession, that would be another part of it.
I mean, I would think that would be really difficult to be a young person knowing that you want to go into teaching because you really believe in teaching and you want to make a difference in students' lives the way one teacher did for you. And at the same time, knowing that you're going into a profession that is so denigrated and even controversial, that would be a hard choice to make.
Absolutely. It feels like something I have to do. I know it's coming. I've heard him describe it. Yet I still feel I have to do it.
Karen, did Mr. Storm give you any advice?
Yeah, he did.
At some point I was talking to someone very experienced in public education, who framed things this way and said, this has always been here in some form. Always, people have told you what to do. people who don't necessarily know what they're doing have told you what to do. Now, I want to be clear to you, like, there are administrators who know what they're doing, but you will be here longer than the administrators, which was true. I went through 5 principals, you know, probably 3 or 4 superintendents. You will be here longer. And part of your job is to... part of your job is to insulate the students from the bullshit. There's just no better word than bullshit. Yeah, part of your job is to insulate the students from that, to protect them from it. You know the best way to run your classroom. So jump through the hoops. But when your students come into the classroom, they know that you have their best interest in mind, not some administrator's best interest in mind. You're there for students and no one else.
He gave me a piece of advice that was really powerful, and it's something that I will remember when I enter the classroom till the day I leave it. There isn't much incentive to go into teaching these days, but when you're in the classroom, making something that just happened yesterday turn into some sort of rich dialogue, it opens up the possibility that your students, too, can look at the world around them and see deeper meanings and feel like agents in their learning life. And I think that's one of the most incredible things that you can do.
Karen McKechnie. Her future students are lucky to have her. Karen is a senior at Grinnell College, and she's on track to get a teaching degree. Tim Storm taught English for 15 years at West High. He's left the public school system, but not what he loves. Today he tutors, and he's launched an online writing school. You can find out more about him on our website at ttbook.org. And coming up...
5 years after the Mexican-American studies ban in TUSD, a legal victory tonight for those who fought to restore the program.
A federal judge has ruled racism was the basis for state superintendents getting a state law that compelled the district to eliminate all classes, curriculum, and course material.
Is teaching Mexican-American studies in public school un-American? A federal judge has ruled no. We go to Tucson, Arizona next to meet the teachers. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
My name is Jose Gonzalez, and I am born and raised in Tucson, Arizona, and I've been teaching the past 25 years.
I'm Curtis Acosta. I was born in Mountain View, California, in the South Bay Area, and I moved here to Tucson about 20-odd years ago. I started teaching right after that.
In Tucson, Arizona, Jose Gonzalez and Curtis Acosta are known to a lot of people as the teachers who helped start a successful Mexican-American studies program for Latino public school students, and also as subjects in a documentary about the program, Precious Knowledge. Now, the Mexican American Studies program came under attack in the mid-2000s when Arizona's school superintendent called it un-American. He also said it promoted the overthrow of the U.S. government. In 2012, the Arizona state government forced the school district to cut the program. Now, 5 years later, a federal judge has ruled the ban unconstitutional and said it was motivated by race-based fear. Steve Paulson sat down with Jose Gonzalez and Curtis Acosta to talk about the program they helped start and why they began teaching it in the first place.
My father is an avid reader and loves history. And, you know, my parents come from Mexico. I'm a first-generation Mexican-American. And so he would often share stories, you know, when we were driving to Mexico about the name of the rivers and mountains that indigenous people, the Otam, called them and give us stories. So I was always fascinated and loved history. My junior year at Choya High School, I had a teacher, Mr. Johnson, and he was a great coach, you know, but he was an awful teacher. This guy would read to us, you know, Mr. Johnson would read to us. And I remember, you know, I raised my hand one day and I asked him, you know, Mr. Johnson, you know, we can read. Because he would sit and read to us, and obviously we'd all fall asleep. And that was his classroom management. I look at that as, you know, as educational malpractice. And that was one of my motivating pieces to become a history teacher and a political science teacher as well.
So, Curtis, what about you? Yeah. Were there any personal experiences for you that led you to want to teach these kind of classes?
You know, very similar, actually, to Jose's story. I'm biracial. My parents met and fell in love in high school, and my dad's Chicano, and my mom's of European descent. And so my experiences were of erasure. You know, my Chicano side, my dad's side of the family was non-existent as far as in schools.
I recall my grandmother telling me a long time ago when she knew I was going to become a teacher, and she's from Mexico, and she said to me in Spanish, she said, Mijo, you want to work with kids? That's beautiful. You have to first touch their heart in order to work with their minds. And so when I entered the classroom, there was racialized trauma that I endured from teachers through my K-12 setting. And
give me an example of that. What was racialized trauma?
Racialized trauma is in third grade. This woman, she was a nun, and her name was Sister Claudia, and she was mean. And so Sister Claudia had thought I had been talking while we were reading silently. And so she called me up to the board and started asking me to spell these words that she had just given us. And so she was making an example of me. And so she was just like badgering me, you know, how do you spell this word, you know? And I'm thinking, you just gave them to us. And so I have my eyes down and everyone's looking, no one's saying anything. And then I yelled to her, I said, this isn't right. And I walked out. And so as such, we had lived experiences that other people may not, and we drew from those. And so in how we interacted, you know, we were culturally relevant before culturally relevant was popular. You know,
so how did you do that in the classroom then? I mean, what was your mission there in the classroom?
Well, I'll give an example, a concrete like example, because it fits really with what Jose is saying about his experiences. So every year we would read in my literature class, because I taught literature, Jose taught social studies. In my literature class, we'd read Indian Education by Sherman Alexie, like within the first 2 weeks of school, because he writes vignettes from first grade through graduation. He has this exact example that Jose was talking about, being spotlighted, or, you know, that's the word we use in teaching. When you're unfair to a certain student, you put them on spot, right? And so our students would read this or hear a story like Jose's, and they would immediately be able to engage with it. So every year, within a week, my students were writing reflections about the discrimination that they'd already been through. And that wasn't the prompt. The prompt was, when have you felt like disengaged from school? When have you felt similar to the character, right? And they would go there. So that shows a couple of things. Number one, we were able to build trust right away. So our students were able to recognize within the first 2 weeks of school in our classes that this was a different space. So it's not just about being liked, it's about being loved. And when you're being loved, you have high expectations, and also you're going to have, you know, a discipline. You know, a lot of times you'll hear from a former Attorney General Horn and like our students came to us as blank slates, that they didn't have these experiences and they couldn't make these connections, and that we put these ideas in their head. That's ludicrous.
With ethnic studies, there's a desire to develop ethnic solidarity You know, this group, we're the Latinos, that other group, they're the African Americans, that other group, they're the Asian Americans, the other group, they're the Anglos, and so on. In the human being, there is a primitive part that is tribal. And that will say, you know, I want to be with members of my own tribe, members of my own race, and that sort of thing. And the function of civilization and the function of our public school system is to get people to transcend that. There are better ways to get students to perform academically and to want to go into college than to try to infuse them with racial ideas.
So do you think they're, you don't think they're doing anything right then?
I really don't. No, I think they should be abolished.
So how did your students respond to these classes?
Well, teaching is love, and that's not taught in colleges of education. And so in love, as Curtis stated, you know, it's a familial love, a parental love. And so students love being in these spaces.
You know, high school can be incredibly alienating. It can be an incredibly dangerous space and not a safe space for students because of cliques, because of bullying, because of those things. And our classrooms were the opposite of that. They were antithetical to that. They were free spaces, open spaces. And that was because we were helping them and giving them time and space to develop who they were and who they wanted to be. And that was the key to an academic identity being built.
So let me ask about the criticisms that were leveled against your ethnic studies program. You know, you came under attack. The state superintendent of schools back then said these programs were divisive because they separated people into different ethnic and racial groups. They said your classes were un-American. They promoted resentment against white people. How do you respond to those charges?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of the folks that heard about us, they were inspired from fear and losing control of a single narrative that is not really the narrative of this country.
What were they fearful of, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, we're all living in 2017, so it's, you know, we were the United States here in Arizona before the United States turned into Arizona. So, you know, you see it with the border wall. We live here in Arizona. We're 60 miles from the frontera, the border. We have heard this rhetoric for not only generations, but it's intensified over the last 20 years.
Mr. Chairman, what's being done down here in Tucson Unified School District is teaching of hate speech, sedition, anti-American. If people want to pay for that on their own dime in their homes, they can be as anti-American as they want. But they won't use my tax dollars to do it.
To answer your question, it doesn't teach us to be anti-American. It teaches us to embrace America, all of its flaws and all. But certain things like racism and certain things like oppression, they do exist. And we go for these classes first off from hearsay, because people that have graduated and gone to these classes have said nothing but positive things. They figured out who they really are as human beings. They figured out how to handle situations to their best abilities. So it doesn't, the word anti-American isn't even relevant in our classes.
So, Jose, how do you respond to that charge that these classes were un-American? Or another way of putting it is that when you were teaching history, you were teaching the bad stuff about history, not the successes of the founding fathers and, you know, the other great pieces of American history.
I laugh. At one point, it was funny, but it became very serious. Our students were traumatized by this. We were accused of overthrowing the United States government as the first prong. Second prong was creating resentment, in other words, reverse racism, if you will. And the third one was these classes were specifically designed for a single group. And the fourth was creating ethnic chauvinism. And so how does a person just kind of come to grips with this, you know, this idea that somewhere in Arizona and around the United States, people actually think that a core teachers were teaching the overthrow of the United States government?
The fear is you're breaking away from those traditions that we know resulted in freedom, that we know resulted in prosperity. There's a real fear when we see books like The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. That's Marxist, Leninist, collectivist. And that's part of the fear that people have about the kind of studies.
But the civil rights movement was something that everybody was afraid of, right?
Well, some were. Some other people.
Most people were afraid of that.
Yeah. You know, there was. I think there was concern. It's legitimate to say there was concern.
A lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What it's about is the American culture has an outline for every single one of us. And that is an oppression. It is an oppression on all of us.
stereotypes and people that, you know, seen me, the way I dress, the way I look. And I started believing that, you know. I started thinking, you know, I'm a Chicana, I ain't going to be able to graduate, I'm going to have kids young, I'm going to, you know, like that. And then I started coming to these classes and I started seeing, like, why am I believing all this? Instead of believing it, I should change it.
But when I look up at the wall and I see a poster of Che Guevara, who many of us think was a thug, and I don't see anything on Benjamin Franklin, I have a problem. I have a problem.
So the ethnic studies program was banned. What impact did that have on, personally, on the two of you?
Well, it's had a tremendous amount of impact. And so even to this day, here in Tucson Unified, you know, I'm having a hard time finding employment and moving up. There are people who really do think that we taught the overthrow of the United States government and so think that we're bad apples. But ultimately, how it's impacted me is my students crying and asking me, begging me to teach the curriculum that I was teaching them before. I'm still very angry. I ran into one of the board members and he tried to shake my hand, and I need to forgive him, but I'm just not there.
Yeah. Curtis, what about you? What was the impact on the banning of this program for you personally?
Well, I left TUSD after a year of trying what Jose still lives every day.
You left being a teacher because you were so upset at what happened?
Well, I didn't leave being a teacher.
But you left the Tucson Public Schools.
I did. I was, the entire time we were going through our civil rights struggle here, I was also getting my PhD. But I did a year of what Jose is talking about, being banned. It was like being a doctor and having the drugs that can help heal people, like the penicillin, in your cabinets, but you can't dispense it. That's how dehumanizing that year was for me. So I left, and now I'm a professor here at the University of Arizona South.
Now, it seems to me there is a big irony in this whole story. I mean, after the ban of your Mexican-American studies program in Arizona, a lot of other states, when they heard about this, when they heard about what you'd done, I mean, from California to Texas, have actually started their own Mexican-American studies programs because they heard about the success of yours. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, how that just took off. And I had a friend, I was in San Diego. She says, you know, Seth, you may not be ready to hear this, but you all with Mexican-American studies, you're all martyrs. And what you're going to see is you're going to see all these Mexican-American studies programs develop all across the United States. And so that's what's happened.
Wow. I mean, that must make you feel weird. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, I guess you've sort of become heroes to some of these people, but martyrs, I mean, that's like, wow. I mean, that's – who wants to be a martyr?
Yeah, you know, and so the conversation, let me just say, was interesting because that didn't sit well with me. But in hindsight, you know, she was right. There's an old Mexican proverb, and it states, it goes something to this effect, and it states that, you know, they thought they buried us. And what they didn't know is that we were the seeds.
Most of the books, you pick up a history book, and you don't really see any other cultures in there, but, you know, mostly Caucasian, white people.
Ethnic studies is the knowledge of other than your own ethnicity.
Not only learning about the past of the U.S., but also learning and having the opportunity to learn about our cultura.
My grandpa, my grandma taught me to be proud that I'm Mexican. And these classes helped me because I actually know my history now.
For someone that's felt so out of place, it feels good to have a home.
The way things were going, I probably just would have just left school.
Jose Gonzalez and Curtis Acosta helped create and fight for Mexican-American studies in Tucson's public schools. In August, a federal judge ruled that the state's ban on the program was unconstitutional and motivated by race-based fears. Thanks to Ari Palo, the Independent Television Service, and Latino Public Broadcasting for excerpts from their documentary about the program. It's called Precious Knowledge. When we talk about education, so often we wind up talking about test scores and graduation rates. And those matter. But learning how to spit the right answers back on a test is not the point of education. Shouldn't it be learning how to question answers, how to think for yourself? Historically, bad things happen when people forget that.
My father was a journalist in 1948 when the Stalinist purges began and the communist coups.
Ever since the end of World War II, Russia's interest in Czechoslovakia had increased steadily.
I mean, he barely escaped, he and my mother, with their lives, because he was standing up for, to put it so crudely, but essentially for the truth.
Finally, the communist coup was totally successful, and the victors celebrated in the streets of Prague.
And the truth did not give you a long lifespan in 1948 in Czechoslovakia. They were constantly sort of asking me, well, what about this? What about that? It's like, why do you believe that? You know, defend your argument.
This is Radio Free Europe calling Czechoslovakia.
The heart counted. It counted a great deal, but reason had to carry the day.
Coming up, educating for democracy. What does that even mean? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. I have two kids in college, which means I have zero disposable income. It also means I worry about what comes after their expensive education. I mean, what exactly will they have learned? And will it get them a job? A lot of people share my concerns, especially other parents of college students, but maybe we're missing the point. Mark Sloka is the son of Czech immigrants. His parents survived the Nazis, but then nearly lost their lives in the communist purges. Eventually, they were smuggled out of their own country, and they made it here. And it's partly because of their experience that Mark is a champion of the humanities. Some years ago, he wrote an essay that people are still quoting from. It's called Dehumanized, When Math and Science Rule the School. And it's basically his case for the civic value of the arts and humanities. And today, he says, we're still asking the wrong questions about education.
Oh, I think a number of things are really significant. It's sort of the vocational thrust of education. That is, education is meant to get us a job. Education is about this 22-year-old coming out of college and being job-worthy and ready. When everything becomes about creating workers, which is vital but only one part of the educational picture, I would argue, then it seems to me that someone like Donald Trump stands at the end of that row, someone who's single criterion for value is monetary. It either makes money or it doesn't.
Well, I have to say, as the parent of two children in college, I really worry about whether they're going to graduate and get jobs.
Of course. No, I had two kids in college too, and I drive a 1995, you know, Corolla. I don't have a lot of money. Naturally, I want my kids to be employed. But I also want them to be educated in the broader civic sense of the word. And I think that education ideally should accomplish both, and it shouldn't be that difficult to do.
You wrote at one point that there are many things that math and science do well and some they don't. And one of the things they don't do well is democracy.
Right.
Can you explain?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one way to approach this is to look at the fact that, I don't know, if I were to apply for a Fulbright to teach, and, you know, they have a long list of foreign countries where you can teach. As you move toward autocratic regimes, if I were to teach in Azerbaijan, if I were to teach in Iran, the things that I'm welcomed to teach are invariably the sciences. If I'm offering to teach history, literature, psychology, political science, the door is closed.
And why is that?
Because autocratic regimes fear the humanities, because what the humanities are a kind of a democracy delivery device. I mean, look, what the sciences are after basically are universal truths, universal physical truths. What the humanities do is something radically different. They attack your certainties. They attack your comfort zones. They force you to continually revise what you know, how you know it, whether you still believe it, whether it's true, whether it's kind, whether it's justified. If an autocratic regime depends on a certain kind of moral certainty, on a certain kind of, you know, Manichaean black and white view of the world, then the last thing in the world you want is for your students to be open to competing arguments, competing facts.
Well, sciences also teach modes and methods of thinking. They're wonderful at teaching analytical thought, you know, the ability to follow an argument, to entertain different kinds
Agreed.
Of arguments.
But it'll be an analytical argument, and it'll be – it's a different kind of argument is what I'm
well,
saying.
Well, I guess – and to that point that ideally it should be both. I mean, no one's actually suggesting getting rid of English classes. So in what ways do you feel the humanities are – endangered or under attack?
The budget cuts in the arts have been legendary, but I think that more important to me is that the arts and the humanities have begun to try to justify themselves in market terms.
How so?
The people in the arts and humanities would feel that the only way that they could legitimately argue for themselves was to use the, in a sense, the other side's vocabulary. That is, the arts will actually make you a better business manager because it will give you this quality or that quality. It doesn't work. The arts.
Sure. All those articles about how, no, really, Silicon Valley wants English majors.
Right. Exactly. It's just, it's not a game you're going to win. You know, I would argue that this country was founded on rebellion and that rebellion is only possible if you have a truly broad base of information from which to resist inherited truths.
You're making me think that there's something, or should be something, inherently political about teaching, in the sense that it's about helping students develop a relationship with power and an ability to withstand power.
I think that's perfectly said. Yes, I do. If education has a political component, it's a deep component. It's a buried component. I think that reading is inherently political in that it forces you to create provisional truths, the ability to sort of say, no, I think I was wrong. I have to adjust my point of view. A good education gives you that capacity. A hollowed out education may succeed on one level and an important level, which is, you know, Johnny, Sally, you know, here's your job and here's your salary. Good. But that's possible in Singapore as well. I mean, you'll possibly have a very good job, but the society you're living in is a very tightly controlled, anti-democratic one.
I'm curious about where some of your sensitivity to some of these issues comes from, because you wrote a memoir, Nobody's Son, in which you talk some about your parents' past. They were born in Czechoslovakia and escaped the Nazis. Do you think having that family background sensitized you to some of the things that we're talking about?
I have no doubt it did. None whatsoever. My dad actually was he worked for Radio Free Europe for a long time, which later on became a kind of an anti-communist, you know, organ and became more problematic. But in the 50s and early 60s, it had a real role to play. One of the things that he was very moved by and wrote about and was concerned about was the whole McCarthy period in the early 50s. And it was less about Senator McCarthy himself than it was about his enablers, sort of the yes men and women who jumped on that bandwagon, and the way fear began to operate on people, the way it will. Very few of us are really that strong or that noble. We will be influenced if our job is on the line, if our career is on the line, further down the road, if our lives are on the line. That left a huge impression on them, that sense that, you know, that can happen here, that tide of unreason, that willingness to demonize groups that you don't fully understand, which is what we're seeing today, in my opinion.
I was going to say, you could be talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is how hate works. I mean, hate works on moral certainty. And one of the ways you accomplish that, it seems to me, is that you create these gigantic identity blocks, which can be as big as nationality, as religion, and then they break down further into smaller blocks like, you know, Democrat, Republican, red state, blue state, gun owner, all of those categories. The reason they're kind of a lie and a sophisticated one is that they mask the fact that, you know, I don't know, Wayne LaPierre and I are both presumably straight, white, American men. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that says what? To my mind, it says absolutely nothing. I mean, yeah, okay, so we're straight, white, American men, but I probably have more in common with, you know, 100,000 gay Ugandan women than I do with Wayne LaPierre. So I guess this brings us back to education. I think mm-hmm. one of the things that education does is that it confuses those identity blocks, that it asks you to be someone else for a time.
Well, you've been making the case throughout this conversation for reclaiming
yeah.
the radical nature of education.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous, and it ought to be dangerous. I mean, it's not for the faint of heart, and it's not for those who can't stand the heat. A true education will challenge everything that you believe.
Mark Sloka is a novelist and essayist. His most recent book is a memoir called Nobody's Son. And we were talking about a famous piece he wrote for Harper's called Dehumanized, When Math and Science Rule the School. It's worth reading. The link's on our website at ttbook.org.
I've been haunted by the Odyssey my entire life.
I am Ulysses, conqueror of Troy.
It's, I think one could argue, the first science fiction narrative. You know, this guy leaves home and experiences strange new worlds.
The anger of the gods pursued me. Many disasters smote me.
And boldly goes in where no one has gone before.
And my men were drowned.
But beyond that, it's one of the great love stories. It's a husband-wife story. It's a father-son story.
There across the wide and dark sea is my home.
And it's the great homecoming epic. It's about what it means to want to go home.
My son, my wife.
Each time I teach it, I reread it. It's just been with me my whole life. My dad, he was in many ways self-educated. I mean, he's been a voracious reader since childhood. He wanted to keep educating himself even into his ninth decade.
But I am here. Undestroyed.
I said, well, do you want to participate? Do you want to just sit there and sort of audit the class? And he said, oh, I'll sit in the back. I won't say a word.
I beg, O brother King Alcinous, a ship to bring me back to Ithaca.
We were 5 minutes into the first session of the seminar, and his hand flew up. He started ranting against what a horrible guy he thought Odysseus was. And I just rolled my eyes and I thought, oh, God, I'm screwed.
Daniel Mendelsohn is a well-known writer and a classics professor at Bard College. And that semester was, in fact, kind of weird, but in a good way. Having his dad there made his class a lot livelier. It also brought the two of them closer together. They even wound up taking a Mediterranean cruise together, retracing the journey of Odysseus. Daniel writes about the whole experience in a new book called An Odyssey, A Father, a Son, and an Epic. And he told Steve Paulson that even though he had been teaching the Odyssey for years, his father got him thinking about it in new ways.
You know, it was funny because, well, I'm a classicist. I'm steeped in all of this. My father was not. And yet he sort of intuitively honed in on some of the great questions that scholars have been asking for millennia now about the character of Odysseus. And the fact is, as my father, you know, incessantly zeroed in on, he's a very shady character, actually. You know,
right, he's a
he
liar.
Goes,
I mean, he's a trickster and, not to mention, an adulterer.
He's an adulterer. He's a liar. And, you know, as my father pointed out the first day of class, he went off to Troy with how many dozens of ships and comes back 20 years later with no survivors. So he's not a particularly good captain. He is this problematic character. And my dad zeroed in on it from the beginning. He didn't like him.
And it's worth pointing out that during the 10 years that he's on his journey back home, he spends 7 years with Calypso, this, you know, very attractive goddess.
Yeah,
and, you know,
but that's
sleeping
what I'm
with her.
Saying. Well, he's being held by her. I mean, the text actually makes it very clear that he's there against his will, even though they sleep together every night. So, you know, but it is wonderful. You know, there's that passage where we hear that she, Calypso, the nymph who's in love with him and holds him for 7 years, offers him immortality if only he will stay with her. And he says no. I mean, that's one of the great gestures, I think, in Western literature. He wants the one woman who's the right woman for him.
Hmm. So basically, it sounds like your dad was picking a fight with Homer and with you on how to interpret the life of Odysseus.
Yes. You know, so at first I just thought, this is going to be a nightmare. You know, I couldn't ever make a point without him, you know, chiming in from left field. But the fact was, it ended up being really wonderful for the seminar, because this was a freshman seminar for first-year students at Bard. And they can be overawed and a little quiet and intimidated. But you know, I realized it was good for the dynamic of the class to have someone opposing the professor all the time, because I think it emboldened the students to feel free to be independent-minded in a way I think that would not have been the case if he hadn't been there.
So the students liked your father in the class?
Yeah. I think they loved having – well, it was also a big kick for them. Here they are, you know, teenagers, and the professor is supposed to be, you know, this – the authority figure. And there was somebody there who was had more authority than I did just because he was my dad. You know, right. I think it was quite funny for them.
You know, this strikes me as really a debate about how we should read literature. I mean, you know, what's at stake in these contrasting interpretations of the character of Odysseus? Was he a good man or not? You know, how are we supposed to respond to a story that's nearly 3,000 years old, when the meaning of honor and the good life and all of that would seem to be very different than what we make of those things?
Yes. But I mean, this is why it's so wonderful to teach it, because the point of great literature is that it explores complexity. It's not black and white. And Odysseus, as I, you know, we were just discussing, he is a dark character in many ways, but in other ways, he's a wonderful character. You know, he is attractive and brilliant and funny and impressive in many ways. And he does love his wife, you know, despite the 7 years of nightly sleeping with Calypso. You know, he really does love it. So, but I love the fact that you have to debate his character. You just have to accept his complexity. You know, the greatest characters, the heroes of the greatest works of all literature are deeply complicated. And Odysseus, I think, is the preeminent example of that. And it's good for the students, I think, to realize that.
So there's another piece of your own story. You and your dad, after the class, went on a cruise around the Mediterranean, specifically to visit the places where Odysseus went during his 10 years after the Trojan War. And considering that your father didn't exactly like Odysseus that much,
right,
I'm kind of surprised that he'd wanted to go on this cruise.
Yeah, I was very touched. What happened was, just as the semester was winding down, and I would happen to be talking to the woman who had been my graduate school mentor, and she said, you know, there's a cruise that recreates the voyages of Odysseus. And she said, you should go on it. And I thought, oh, my father's never going to want to do that. My father was not one for luxury or vacations or things like that. And I said, well, you know, Daddy, there's this cruise, and Froma went on it. And she said, it's great. He said, let's go. And so off we went.
Well, you tell a great story about visiting the cave of Calypso. And you say that you were actually terrified to go there because it was in a very tight space, and you have a lot of claustrophobia.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not good in small. I would have never spent 7 years with Calypso. Let's put it that way. I don't like being in small enclosed spaces. And we were on Malta at this point. That's where traditionally the cave of Calypso is supposed to be located. And you have to go down a steep hill, and there you see the entrance to this cave, which is just a sort of a cleft in a rock. And I looked at it and I said, I'm not going. I'm just not going. And my father was very adamant. You know, he said, we came all this way and you're not going to go. And then he was very cute. He reached out and he held my hand and he said, I'm going to hold your hand. You're going to be fine. And I went. And it was actually incredibly touching because when we came out, he essentially told us Odysseus-like harmless lie, and he told people that I had been holding his hand because he was old and was worried about his footing. And I thought that was very touching, and that's a sort of big moment in the book.
You know, there to step back for a moment, sort of to put all of this in some sort of bigger context, as you know, there is a huge debate, conversation about the state of the humanities these days and, you know, whether we actually need the humanities. And there is a push in some circles for education that's much more job-focused. People should go to college specifically to develop the skills to work later on. And what we've been talking about is a very different model of what education is all about. And I'm wondering how you think about these issues.
Well, you know, I'm as a writer and a humanist and a professor of literature, I would put it this way. When your parent dies, which is going to happen to everybody, your law degree or your accounting degree or your STEM degree, whatever it is not going to help you deal with that. But if you've read The Odyssey, if you've read great literature, you have some help in dealing with these great life experiences because that's what literature is about. The Odyssey is also about mortality. Odysseus comes back. His own father is now a very old man, and his own mortality is something the poem explores. And I'm glad I read The Odyssey because, in fact, when my own father did become ill and finally died, I had something to help me think about that experience. So to the people who say, you know, the humanities aren't practical, I would always say your model of practicality is very limited, if that's what you think, because the humanities are about human life. That's all it means. Obviously, I'm not naive. You have to make a living. You have to have a job. But I don't... You know, I think this whole debate is infected by a kind of false thinking. These are not either-or decisions. You need these things. You need art. You need literature to tell you how to be a human being, which is more than just bringing home a paycheck, because then what do?
That's Daniel Mendelsohn talking with Steve. His memoir is called An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. And that's it for this hour. If you have thoughts about it, share them. You'll find us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. And huge thanks today to Karen McKechnie, our summer intern. This show was her idea, and she produced a lot of it. Our staff also includes the irrepressible Charles Monroe Kane, our resident lonely genius Doug Gordon, Mr. All Things Digital Mark Rickers, my husband and executive producer, Steve Paulson, and the sonic virtuoso in the control room, technical director Joe Hartke. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for spending your time with us.